Thank you, Ali. And thank you, Professor Burns, for having started these lecture series. I feel a bit out of place for two reasons. One, after getting the list of the previous distinguished lecturers, I feel a bit out of place after Cummings and Scotchpole and so on. Also, I feel out of place in this very pleasant environment, actually beautiful scene, talking about such unpleasant topics as coups, oil, and nuclear bombs. So I hope you'll bear with me and try to ignore the scenes, the beautiful environment you have here, and jump back in history and look at some of the things of the early 50s. So I've been last 10 years sort of revisiting the period of 51-53, which for United States wasn't very important, but for Iran it was, you can say, the crucial period in modern history until, of course, the 1979 revolution. For those of you who are too young to remember or haven't studied this period, in April of 1951, the Iranian parliament nationalized the oil industry in Iran, which was owned by the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, a British company, which is now known as British Petroleum, and sometimes bills itself as Better Petroleum or Beyond Petroleum. The terminology is often changed, but it used to be originally called Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. That company had a monopoly over the oil industry in Iran, and in 51, in fact, the largest oil refinery in the world was in Iran, and Iran was the second largest exporter of petroleum. So it was a vital resource at that time. When the Iranian parliament nationalized the oil, it also appointed Dr. Mossadegh, Mohammad Mossadegh, as prime minister to implement this law, the nationalization law. This automatically triggered a major international crisis that lasted 28 months. From April on till August of 53, it was basically a front page news internationally, because Iran was taken to The Hague first, then to the United Nations. It became, you could say, almost an explosive issue. Warships were sent off to the Persian Gulf and so on. And this crisis over oil was not resolved until August 53, when the CIA, together with the British Secret Service, MI6, overthrew Mossadegh, brought back the Shah, who then promptly denationalized, really, the oil industry. So this period for Iranian history was very crucial. Now, much has been written in English about the oil crisis. There are umpteen books on the oil crisis. There are also actually now a lot written on the coup itself. So there is, one could say, there is nothing new one can say what has been already published on it. And these are well-known books now in the literature, both on oil and the coups. But the conventional wisdom, I would say, on both the crisis and the coup tends to inevitably miss, really, I think, two things that are crucial. You could say there is a conventional history of it, the narrative that's given, is the following, that once the Iranians nationalized the oil industry, and this prompted a confrontation between Britain and Iran, the U.S. came in as an honest broker, trying to mediate between the two. The U.S. put together a nice compromise, a fair compromise, And this compromise could have been basically the solution to the crisis. But it was due to Mossadegh's Iranian intransigency that this was rejected. And once it was rejected, Iran went into an economic crisis. This then prompted the fear that communism was going to take over in Iran. And therefore, the coup was carried out in August 53 as a way of preventing a communist coup in Iran. In fact, Kermit Roosevelt, who organized the coup, when he wrote his book on the coup, he didn't call it the coup, he called it the counter-coup. And the argument was that this was done to preempt a communist coup that would have occurred. And the argument here is that very much that it was the coup was a part of the Cold War context. And the many books that have been written on this period really put it in the Cold War context. And the literature there always stresses that the American compromise, which the British were willing to accept, would have solved the problem, except for it was the Mossadegh for either his complex, they sometimes blame it on the Shi'i complex of martyrdom, inability to compromise, supposedly an Iranian trait, and also that sometimes people argued that that he would was feared that his own supporters would tear him apart if he compromised. It was basically that bottleneck that led to lack of resolution. So 2 months ago, a new book was published, very favorable to Mossadegh. The author, an English author living in Iran, has interviewed a lot of Mossadegh's family supporters. And even he, this very favorable book, laudatory book, I would say, the bottom line is that the Mossadegh could have resolved the problem if it wasn't due to bad advisors, because the Americans had put on the table a good solution, which the British were willing to accept, but it was the Iranians who refused to reject it. Now, this you can say is become the established narrative. My own work that looking at the actual documents, especially negotiation documents, British-American oil company, gives to me a very different conclusion. And the conclusion I've come to is very much that there was, in fact, no compromise given to Mossadegh. Secondly, the coup, eventual coup, was not really to do with the Cold War. This was basically a bogey issue. Communism was brought in. The coup was done mainly because it was both in American and British interest to denationalize the oil and make sure that the nationalization campaign wouldn't succeed. This is, remember, talking early 50s. So what I'll do today is actually try to argue these two, you can call it revisionist interpretations. I won't have time actually to go too much into the coup part because I want to leave time to look at the contemporary period, because there are striking parallels between the oil crisis of 51-53 and the present sort of standoff over the nuclear issue between United States and Iran. So I'll try to leave some time to make it, to fast forward to the present, because how Iranians see it is very much through the 53 coup, very unlike the United States. Now, looking at the question of oil, nationalization, if it means anything, means that the country has control over that part of the sector of the economy. And when Iran nationalized the oil, what it was doing was taking control over the drilling, the refining, and export of petroleum. Now, this was, of course, had been done in Mexico earlier in 1938-39, but it hadn't been done in the Middle East before. So this was very much a radical step at that time. And from the beginning, the British position always was that Iran should not get control over its oil resources, that the operative word always in the documents is actually the word control. But significantly, when you look at public declarations and when the press talked about it, the word control was never used. And I was looking at a memoir one of my former professors had written about oil. Is Charles Izawi, is a sort of Middle East economist, and he wrote a piece on oil. And here he, memoir, he just drops as a side remark that at one time he was interested writing a book on oil, and people from Aramco, the main oil companies, they said, oh, an academic could never understand the complexities of the oil industry, don't bother. But he went ahead and wrote a book on oil, and he sent the manuscript to Aramco, and they circulated among other oil companies. And the only criticism they had when it came back was why had he used the word control? Because he had written that the Seven Sisters, the big oil companies, controlled so much of oil, the industry. They objected to this word oil, or control. They rather he had said they owned or did something, but the word control for them was clearly taboo. And what you find throughout the 51-53 crisis is that what Iran is trying to get, and what for Mossad there, a nationalization means, is actually control. And the British realize that. They want to make sure that they retain control, and Iran does not have control over production. And this even goes back before the 51 law, because in 1945, the Soviets had demanded a concession in northern Iran. This is sort of a footnote to the bigger crisis. And the British had been very reluctant to see the Soviets getting an oil concession there, not so much because of Soviet extension, but what it would have set an example, because they feared that once the Soviets set a company in the north and that would have a time limit, then it would be passed on to Iran. Iranian control over that oil would be a major threat to British control over oil in the south. So here is actually the British Ministry of Fuel, which was in charge of negotiations, says, they write, this is in 1945, the strength of British oil lies in the fact that we hold concessions all over the world in which we ourselves are developing oil and controlling its distribution and disposal. It would weaken our position if countries began to develop their own oil. If Persia, and of course Persia for Britain was the old term for Iran, if Persia began to develop her own oil in the north, it might not be very long before she would demand to do this in the south. We should not encourage them to develop their own oil. And this argument and fear constantly is from 51-53, is that if Britain loses control over the production, then it's the state, the country, that gains the control. And that has longer repercussions. And again, I won't read directly, but what these documents stress always, it's the oil-producing countries don't have the same interests as oil-consuming countries. Putting it in simple terms, if you're an oil-producing country, you might decide that it's best to keep production low because that way you keep the price high. And logically also, in terms of self-interest, if you have oil underground, it might be worth more 20 years, 30 years now. So why bring it out, sell it cheap, when your natural resources are going to be more valuable in future? So the nationalization wasn't just a small question of, you know, who's actually going to run the oil, but it had long-range repercussions, basically going into international, worldwide, for the next 20, 30 years. So right from the beginning, the British interest was to make sure that actually they wouldn't lose control. So in the negotiations, they're quite clear they're willing to have better agreement. Let's, at that time, it was 50-50 agreement of sharing the profits. They at one point even actually privately say that they're willing to give Iran 60% of the profits, just keep 40%, which would have undermined the old American companies, because the American guy was 50-50. They were willing to go to 60, but they said, we have to keep control. And they also said that Mossadegh is really serious about this. He is not going to be hoodwinked or talked into being given more money. He actually is a real nationalist. He wants control. So from the beginning, you can say that there was a zero-sum game conflict over control, over who was going to have this. And the Iranian nationalists headed by Mossad there were dead serious about the issue of nationalization. And the British were also dead serious that they were not going to lose control. Now, where does the U.S. fit in this? Well, the idea that U.S. actually was an impartial observer that was dragged in doesn't really bear out when you look at what behind the scenes. The U.S. was critical of the British Oil Company before 53 on the grounds that the British were too miserly, that they weren't willing to offer 50-50. They were, if you compared the British deal with Iran compared to American deals with Venezuela, the British were very stingy, so they talked about they should have a better agreement, 50-50. And the British government also agreed with this, actually. The British government often blamed the reason that the oil company was so stingy was that they were controlled by Scots. In England, Scots are usually considered very money-pinching and so on. So the poor Scottish character was the explanation for why the oil company had got into this problem. And the notion was, well, if they had offered 50-50 earlier, there would never have been a crisis. But the U.S., despite this criticism of the British, the U.S. was always adamant that nationalization should not be accepted. In fact, as soon as the bill was passed in Parliament in April 51, the Assistant Secretary of State, the U.S. Secretary of State, George McGee, interesting character. He himself was an oil man before. He quickly rushed off from Washington to Tehran to talk to the Shah and persuade the Shah that he shouldn't sign this oil law. And of course, in the Iranian constitution, the law had was not already law until it was finalized by the Shah. And once he got there to persuade the Shah not to sign, because he said this would be a disastrous thing to sign, he realized that the mood in the country was such that the Shah was actually going to have to sign. He couldn't persuade the Shah not to sign. You find also, if you talk to the read the documents of American advisors to the Iranian government, there were two main oil advisors. They, although they were very critical of the British oil company, they were also adamant that nationalization was a terrible idea. And their argument was actually Iran was not mature enough, didn't have enough technicians, engineers to run the oil industry. And they argued that way that actually nationalization would be a bad idea. All of which actually turned out to be not true because after nationalization in 1953, when the World Bank went to look at the industry, they discovered actually their industry was functioning perfectly well by local engineers and technicians. So that argument really probably was not the real argument. Again, they felt that this would be a major threat to the international world market if Iran got hold of control over its industry. And you find throughout the negotiations from 51 to 53, the US is very much involved. And throughout these discussions, what their strategy is to persuade Mossadegh that it's not a good idea. So they would come with incredible documents of price of oil in Venezuela versus Iran, the technical difficulties, issue of tankers, and they would flood him, basically try to drown him with technical matters. But the bottom line was for the Americans that nationalization was bad. And the words they used was that they were trying to educate Mossadegh. From Mossadegh's point of view, they were trying to take him for a ride because you would get flooded by documents, statistics, but all he was looking for is the bottom line. Who's going to control the actual decision? Do we produce this much oil or this much oil? Who do we sell it to? And they would try to basically camouflage all this on technical stuff. So this made them very frustrated because they couldn't hoodwink or persuade Mossadegh to give up the question of nationalization. So as a result, what you find in the documents, and then it filters into the press, and the media was very much working together with the State Department, the British Foreign Office. I'm not talking about tabloid press, but highbrow press, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. They were very much in coalition together on this issue. It's a very sort of systematic campaign that the reason there is no settlement is basically because of this type of wording they use. And the Iranians are, and these are all terminology that both in the press and in the diplomatic documents come in. Iranians are irrational, headstrong, tiresome, obstinate, violent, unstable, malcontented, inefficient, ignorant, xenophobic, childlike, unwilling to recognize facts, emotionally mystical, swayed by emotions, devoid of positive content. And then Mossadegh is also described as impossible, eccentric, emotional, sickly, fanatical, wild, mentally unstable, abnormal, crazy, demagogic, absurd, single-mindedly obstinate, wily oriental, and to boot, effeminate. So these were the explanations why there was no settlement. And this was such a barrage of materials that this is why even modern historians, when they look at this back, this is easy thing to come caricature that the guy is crazy, it's either because of national character. One book even says it's sort of a genetic problem of Iranians that they couldn't come to a compromise. But what this all camouflage is that the bottom line issue is who is to control oil? And he, as a nationalist, was not going to basically give up that issue. It wasn't something you could compromise it. You either had control or you didn't have control. I found staggering is the close workings between the British embassy in Washington and the American press. They were basically feeding the American press their own version of what was going on. And you have sort of deans of American journalism at that time, the gentleman Drew Pearson. He basically bought everything the British said. And in one point, the British press attaché says that we are feeding the American press poison that is too venison, too dangerous to give to the BBC. Because they didn't want to discredit the BBC by giving false information, but the American press was quite willing to basically dish it out. Things such as that Mossadegh was an opium addict, and therefore, of course, that explained why he couldn't deal with it. And that his right-hand man, Dr. Fatemi, his foreign minister, was a convicted criminal and so on. There was absolutely no actually criminal record, but this was given out. And then Pearson wrote in his Washington Post, do Americans want such a crook to continue masterminding the whole Middle Eastern oil crisis? This man will eventually decide whether the U.S. has oil rationing or possibly whether the American people go into World War III. Obviously, when you put it as a question like that, then the obvious answer is you don't want to deal with such crooks or crazy people. Cultural historians actually would tend to could easily use this stereotyping to say, well, there is a cultural clash. But it wasn't really at bottom. It was, for the diplomats, quite clear that it was a simple question of control. But once they were trying to explain why they couldn't get Mossadegh to do what they wanted, then it was easy to resort to this stereotyping, even racial stereotyping. When some of the British diplomats were, of course, veterans of the India office. India had just got independence, and one of them says, in fact, the Iranians are even worse than Indians. The worst thing you could be, worse than India. Why? Because the Indians had, of course, the audacity to demand independence right at that time. So what I'm here arguing is very much it's a national crisis, national issue between, I would say, insurgent nationalism, very similar to many in Africa, Asia, later called the Third World, and old imperial Britain over control. The U.S. position, I think, is also very much influenced by the oil companies. Because the American diplomats and people like McGee, besides being oilmen, throughout the negotiations were always in touch with American oil companies. And the oil companies were all adamant that this nationalization should not succeed because the repercussions it would have on their agreements throughout the world. And they did. The British themselves actually would draw up a list of all the British companies that would be threatened, things like the Suez Canal, copper industry, and so on, if this nationalization would succeed. And they always made sure that these reports would be passed to the U.S. with a list of American companies that could also be threatened if the nationalization succeeded. So they saw it very much as something that threatened them. And they were quite honest when people like Aramco or Standard Oil, when they talked to McGee, they said that there's no way you can permit this nationalization to succeed. This is basically expropriation. It's the end of the world as we know it, the end of civilization we know it, because it's going to ruin the whole oil world industry with power shifting basically to the oil producers rather than the oil companies themselves. And of course, in the 1970s, we know that that eventually did happen, did control, did. But in the 50s, it was considered basically end of the world if it occurred. There are still, I think, people who are nostalgic for the good old days and would like to go back to the days when the oil companies controlled it rather than oil states. And this might be the hidden agenda in some places, such as in Iraq. We have to wait and see. But there are still people who do dream of shifting power away from the states back to the oil companies. So it's not a dead issue. It's still something that could be revived again. But in 51, 53, the U.S. was as adamant as the British that this nationalization should be basically squashed. Well, as I said earlier, the American tactic was to talk to Mossad there, to sweet talk him or hoodwink him to give up the idea. Once that failed, both the British and the U.S. then tried to actually use politics to get rid of Mossad there. And the way they did it was try to persuade the Shah to dismiss him. Then the Shah refused to do it. This was then seen as the Shah was weak, something that was later on, of course, in 79 revived. Actually, it wasn't weak. The Shah realized politically that if he went against nationalization, he would be basically discrediting himself and the monarchy, because the nationalization issue was the national issue, and the king couldn't really go against that. So he refused to go along with them over dismissing Mossad there. So the British and Americans basically bribed enough deputies in the majlis in July of 52 for them to vote against Mossad there and replace him with another politician, Ravam, who actually was Mossadegh's distant cousin, same age, very much old-time politician, aristocratic politician, but very different politically. He was very willing to compromise and give up the idea of a nationalization. This created actually a revolt in Iran. And as soon as Ravam was appointed prime minister, there was mass demonstrations, general strike. The army started firing. There was riots. The country was on the verge of a revolution. And this became known as the July 52 revolt. And Ravam had to resign. And Mossadegh came back in power with much more, actually, popular support than before, because now he had the legitimacy of a popular revolt. So that the tactic of getting rid of Mossadegh by political means by the U.S. and British failed. So the day after Mossadegh is returned, lo and behold, the British and the American ambassadors agree that the only way now to get rid of Mossadegh is through a coup. And they say, who is the best colonel or general who can we choose, who can be the obvious person to lead the coup. So this is the day after the July revolt. The historiography later says, well, actually the Truman administration was still willing to use diplomacy to settle the issue. It wasn't until Eisenhower came in that people talked about the coup, but I find the evidence actually is much earlier than that. It's under the Truman administration. The ambassador basically is given up trying to sweet talk Mossad there and is talking about a coup. So the origins of the coup really go there, and I won't go into the mechanics. All to say, what I want to stress is when you look at August 53, there is really no danger of a communist takeover. Later on, Mossadegh, in his trial, said the whole thing was a red herring. He knew what the Iranian communists, the Tudeh Party, was doing. He knew they didn't have arms. They were not talking about a coup. They were not powerful enough to organize a coup. They could organize demonstrations, strikes, and so on, but to be able to pull off a coup is a different thing. And the Iranian secret police knew that this was not in the books. You also find in the CIA reports to Washington saying that, in fact, they had obviously spies inside the Tudeh Party, that there was really no preparation, no talk of a coup. But at that time, of course, the press here, the whole idea was because there were mass demonstrations and so on, the country was actually on the verge of a communist takeover. And after the coup, in fact, Eisenhower made a famous ironic speech at a peace conference saying that what had happened in Iran was the public fearing coup had overthrown the dictator Mossadegh and brought in the popular leader, the Shah. And that became the narrative, really, which people picked up, that the coup was really a popular revolt against the fear of communism. But even the CIA admitted in their documents that there was really no fear of a coup in August of 53. You can also see that the British documents, that there was neither, they had always poo-pooed the question. In fact, one of the British diplomats said they used the communists as a bogeyman to scare people, but there was really no realistic threat from that side. In fact, in some of the in the polemics, and of course the Iranian press often published articles that was written by the CIA in Washington, then given out. This was part of the CIA network in Iran, that articles written in Washington would then be published in Persian in Iran. They would accuse this or that minister of the Mossadegh government of being a secret communist there, a fellow traveler, and so on. And clearly the CIA didn't believe this, because the same people after 53 took refuge in the United States. So it would have been against U.S. law to have actually so-called secret communists being permitted into the United States. So these were very reputable, very actually liberal conservative figures, but they were smeared as having secret communist links. Now, fast forward to the present crisis. How long do I have?
Maybe 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
Do you want to have time for questions and comments?
Yeah. You could say this is all past history, dead history. For Iran, it's not, because a lot of contemporary politics in Iran is seen in the prism of 53, because it's the main event early in Iranian history until 79. So when we come to the nuclear issue now, Americans on the whole tend to see the standoff, the nuclear issue, through the prism of Israel, and now, of course, Israelis see it in the prism of the Holocaust. Now, Iranians, however, tend to see it through this 53 coup. And that means basically a very sort of cultural difference on how the present issue is seen, because there are actually striking parallels between the two crises. Just to give you some of the things that comes to my mind. In the oil crisis, Iran argued that it was their own legitimate international right to have sovereignty over their resources. That was their premise. In this crisis, they also argued that it is in the legitimate right of any country to have nuclear scientific knowledge. Especially if they signed the nuclear treaty, international nuclear treaty, which then means they have to observe certain rules. They don't go into weaponry, but as long as they sign it, observe it, they have the legitimate right to have nuclear technology. So there's this same sort of argument about legitimate rights. Similarly, what you find in the oil crisis, the Western powers, the British and Americans, also gave the argument that, yes, you have the right. But in reality, when it came to nitty-gritty, they wanted to make sure they didn't have actually, in practice, control or nationalization. And the same thing appears now with the oil, with the nuclear crisis. The UN or the US position is that, yes, Iran does have the right to have nuclear technology. But when you get to nitty-gritty, the argument is you have the right in theory, but we're not sure whether you're responsible enough, mature enough, trustworthy enough that you can have this technology. Because although in theory you can have it, you may misuse it, and therefore you have to first prove to us that you are not going into the business of weaponry. So it very much becomes reminiscent of imperial powers, in fact, saying, well, we do recognize your right, but you have to first prove to us that you're not. And then, of course, that becomes a problem. The Iranians would say, what do you need us to do to prove that we're not? And that becomes a constant shifting thing. It's very vague when it comes to the nitty-gritty. So, but the press usually takes it as a simple case that, well, if they can prove that they're not doing it, that's fine. But then how is the country going to prove that they're not in ways that is acceptable, when what is acceptable is actually up to the observer to decide? Another similarity is in the 51-53 coup, there was the British imposed embargo, economic financial embargo. They even put warships outside the Persian oil ports, and any tanker leaving Iranian ports was in fact impounded by the British. Some took this as piracy. Ironically, they were impounded Italian ships and Japanese ships around the same area that Somali pirates are active now outside Aden. The Iranians, of course, considered it piracy, but the British argued that they were just impounding their own oil because the oil in the tankers were they belonged to the Anglo-Iranian oil company. Of course, the U.S. oil companies also participated in the embargo, that they refused to buy anything and made sure that Iran was isolated. But the purpose of that embargo, economic embargo, the argument was this would pressure Iran to negotiate over the oil settlement. Well, the real reason was, in fact, to bring about a coup. So now the suspicion in many, for many Iranians would be that the UN embargo is not really designed to pressure Iran to negotiate over oil. The real aim is a coup. But of course, nowadays, the word that is replaced a coup is regime change. So the purpose of the economic pressures is not to get a settlement over the nuclear issue, but actually to overthrow the regime. I'm not saying this is true, but this is how it's very much perceived by many people there. Another similarity is when Britain took Iran to the UN, it argued that this was the Iranian nationalization of the oil company was a threat to international peace and security. And of course, Mossadegh came to the UN and was his big sort of international debut. He made fun of this. He said, well, if Iran had placed warships outside the Thames and threatened to bombard London, this would be a case of endangering international security. It was the British who put ships outside Iran. And anyway, it was international law that you could nationalize oil, nationalize resources. The British, after all, themselves, this was the Labour Party, Socialist Party, had nationalized a few years earlier British industries in United Kingdom. So they couldn't very well argue on principle of against nationalization. So the whole thing was actually that the UN, the British case, was really not taken seriously. It was a big show thing, but it was that even the Western companies, Western countries didn't go along with the British claim. You have the similar thing now that Iran was brought to the UN by the US on the grounds that its nuclear project was a threat to international peace and security. And El Baradei, who was the head of the UN Nuclear Monitoring Group, and in his memoirs he writes, this is just his wording, a UN resolution is of dubious legality. There is no proof that Iran's nuclear activity involves a weapons program. It is quite a stretch to say a small laboratory scale centrifuge cascade constitutes a threat to international peace and security when peaceful uranium enrichment is legal for all states under the NPT, that's the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So here you have actually the head of the nuclear monitoring group thinks that it's really outrageous to go to the extent of a UN resolution when he finds and no one else has found evidence of actually weaponizing or nuclear programs, nuclear weapons programs. Another similarity is, of course, in the question of image press coverage, that here the problem is, again, Iranian intransigence. This time, of course, it's mad mullahs rather than emotional Mossadegh, that they are out to get weapons of mass destruction. They aren't willing to negotiate. And Western powers have offered good choices. Again, when you look at the nitty-gritty, it's much more complicated. It's not always that simple. There have been times often when Iran has actually willing to negotiate on some sort of settlement that would have been actually agreeable to someone to El Baradei. and it had been the U.S. and has we actually not picked up the offer. Not long ago, Brazil and Turkey put something on the table where more enriched uranium would be taken out of Iran, refined, and then brought back for medical purposes. And Iran seemed to accept this, but the U.S. didn't accept it. So that in some ways you could say there, the offer is has been there. The reluctance has been more from the outside rather than inside. So I'm not saying it's always that way. There have been other times when the U.S., especially in the during the earlier period, Clinton period, was willing to much more negotiate. It was the problem came at the other end. By the way, the recent Iranian negotiator who's left the country and very critical of the Ahmadinejad administration has written a very interesting book about negotiations, and he lays out, he's very critical of the Iranian government, but he also points out various times when the U.S. didn't pick up the offer to negotiate. So to end up on a sort of more of an optimistic note, there is one major difference between the oil crisis and the nuclear crisis. In the oil crisis, it was really a zero-sum game. You either got control or you didn't get control. And it was an issue that was very hard to, you can say, compromise. You can't cut up the cake in the middle. It was either one or the other. In the nuclear issue, it's actually much more fuzzy, because if Iran was adamant at getting the bomb and the U.S. was adamant that Iran should not get the bomb, then, of course, you could say it's a zero-sum game, and therefore it wouldn't be settled. But the official Iranian position is that they're not interested in a bomb. They would never think of a bomb. That against even the claim there's a fatwa from Khomeini against the bomb and so on, that bombs don't give security. The Soviet Union had, after all these bombs. It didn't save the Soviet Union, so that they're not putting any assurances on the bomb. What they claim is all they want is basically civilian nuclear knowledge and capability. But of course, capability means that you can have eventually at some point, if you need it in a drastic situation, go from peaceful uses to weaponizing. And that's a sort of a long, elastic stretch, which is probably what they're aiming for, to have the capability of being able to make a bomb if they're faced in a similar situation as they were in during the Iran-Iraqi war, where Saddam Hussein was using weapons of mass destruction on them and they had no deterrence. So from that point of view, it makes rational sense for them to have the nuclear scientists, to have the technology, the equipment, but not to actually make a bomb, but to have the capability. And this sounds sort of pretty dangerous, but there are actually 40 countries in the world that have a nuclear capability to making a bomb if they want to. The closest would be Japan. It's usually said Japan could make a bomb over a long weekend if it needed to. Most countries don't need more than a weekend. And the question is, you know, what sort of time space you have. If Iran is willing to have a very vague time space, that probably would be acceptable for the Obama administration, because that wouldn't be defined as a bomb. And Obama's number of times has said that it's the bomb he is against, but he's left room to maneuver for nuclear technology. So if he is reelected, there would be some sort of settlement on this fussy issue of capability. So there, I think it's not inevitably a clash, because there in the aim at the other end isn't something that dangerous. And that basically makes it a very different situation from the 51-53 crisis.
Thanks, Ervan, for a very thoughtful reading of a very complex crisis in 1953. That's still with us. And that really begs the question to have a dialogue and listening, not only mutual demonization, but also listening and try to understand the other, which is maybe the first step toward having a dialogue and negotiations. The floor is now open for questions and also comments. And I think David wants me to, if you want to ask a question or make a comment, go to David. He has the microphone. Okay. We'll take somebody from here. Yes. Yes, Mike.
Thank you. I'm Michael Cripps from the Department of English. Did you have a Did you have a chance to see the vice presidential debate last night? I'm not sure if you follow American politics at all. The issue of Iran and nuclear weapons or nuclear energy came up and was quite a there was a fair bit of disagreement around that so where the current administration would is and where the potentially the the Republican administration might be if elected. And I want to sort of ask a question. Did you have a chance to see it?
Yes, I did.
Wonderful. So I would just invite you to kind of talk about what you saw there and those differences, thinking about that regime change question, because you say that within Iran, there's some discussion about, wait a second, is the world community or the U.S. in particular really after regime change under the guise of preventing nuclear Iran? And I'm wondering if that, whether that debate, the disagreements there, maybe signals U.S., possible sort of trajectories, depending on whether the Obama administration is reelected or we have a Romney administration in January.
What was struck me with the debate last night is Ryan presumed he knows what the Ayatollahs think. So I was curious, how does he know what they think? Because Iran specialists have a lot of time trying to figure out what they think, and there's not one Ayatollah, there are a lot of different ones. And you have to sort of look at what Iranian negotiators have placed on the table in the past, what their aims are. And here, I think, in Iran, obviously, there are politicians that are somewhat crazy, like the president, okay, Ahmadinejad. They're not very sophisticated on the complexities of American politics. But I think there are enough people in the Iranian Foreign Office who would realize that from even that debate, they would have watched that debate, that there is a distinction between the Obama and Romney administrations, just the wording. And you, I think, touched on the wording. What Ryan was stressing, Iran should not have the capability, okay? And by changing the goalpost, that really then means for the Iranians that there's no negotiations if Romney comes in. While the Obama administration, when they stress no bomb, then, of course, that leaves room for possibility of the capability coming in. So I think the sophisticated people would see the difference. I'm not sure, let's say, if the Romney administration, there is a Romney administration, how different it actually would be. Biden could say, what are you going to do? You're going to send 300,000 men to Iran? If Iran actually says we want a bomb, we're going to go bomb, throw out the UN observers, and actually do what the nightmare is, what's the next line? Okay, U.S. can bomb, but bombing doesn't control it. It's a big country. The nightmare was they would then have a very strong incentive to speed up and break all the taboos and go ahead for the bomb. And then what? And then you're going to occupy the country. And Iran's a big place. Iran has no military capability, but it has a lot of defensive capabilities. It has a huge national guard, basically. It has no real military in the traditional sense of threatening neighbors, but it has a huge national guard it's 400,000 men. It would be an impossible country to occupy. It would make Iraq a sort of a child's game. So it's a lot of this politics for foreign policy. It becomes a sort of a joke for Iran specialists.
Of course, we don't have the Iranian administration yet. That's still a contested issue, of course. Other questions or comments? You have to ask questions. I'm not going to let you go. Okay, Dean, Jeannie Hay.
Thank you so much for being here. What happened in 79 in terms of the oil companies? Was it one day they were out? They managed the situation so effectively in 53. So what did they face in 79?
Actually, this is a hidden story because what the image, and again, the image is, again, very effective but distorts the reality. In 54, after Mossadegh fell, the British company came in with a consortium. So, in fact, the oil then was handed back to the Western oil companies. But the Shah always had this claim that they were under the control of the National Iranian Oil Company. So they claimed that it remained nationalized, but in reality it was run by the oil companies. And then when the oil price zoomed up in 73, the Shah became very militant on high prices. So he looked often in the press that he was basically at the forefront of OPEC. One of the American secretaries of Congress called him a madman or something crazy because the Shah was calling for higher oil prices and so on. In reality, the Shah clearly couldn't do anything because the oil was still controlled by the Western companies. It wasn't until 79 that Iran actually then renationalized the oil company. So Mossadegh's dream was not really fulfilled. But here it's not that clear whether it was because the contract was ending in 79. The concession would have ended in 79. And coincidentally, the revolution occurred. So it never became a conflict issue. The oil companies basically handed over to National Iranian Oil Company.
But if the revolution had never happened, would the Shah have allowed the contracts to be renewed, or would he also have seen the end to them and then...
He would have probably taken over because by then every other country had, even conservative countries like Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, had really nationalized the oil industry. And people often have the misinterpretation that the oil companies run the oil industries in these countries, actually, they don't. It's really the state that does it. And Iran, ironically, was the first country to nationalize, but to implement it, it was the last one, 79.
Thank you.
Other questions? Or maybe thinking? We have also to remember that after 1953 coup, that the Shah came back to Iran. The oil companies came back, as Professor Abrahamian mentioned, but also his followers of Mossadegh were persecuted, and also the press was really controlled, and the old regime came back in full power. That's why some scholars think that without the coup, probably the revolution would not happen in 1979. This is an argument. Sandra has a question, I think.
It may not have been the world's greatest literature, but I really enjoyed reading Lolita in Tehran. And so I wanted to ask you, what's the state of women's education in the country now?
It's actually a fascinating story, because here you have Islamic Republic claimed, established. You would expect a very strong sort of reversal of women's role. And although on some issues, like you have to wear the headscarf and so on, in education, since 79, there has been a huge expansion of the education system. But within that, women have become actually more than 50%. So in the universities, over 50% are women. So you get in the professions a lot of women. Of course, there's a lot of, in terms of gender segregation and so on. But the revolution has opened up, basically, women into higher education and then the professions. And how to explain this, it's hard. One is, I would explain, is that it's part of a universal thing with expansion of middle class professions. Naturally, then women have to be put into the labor force or recruited. But then there's another thing, that even conservative ayatollahs, they have daughters. The daughters get educated, and they also then demand rights. So, for instance, right at the moment, you would expect sort of core of the establishment, the daughter of Rafsanjani, who was the former president, is sort of the conservative senior politician of Iran, his daughter's in prison. Why? Because she's an Islamic feminist. So the scarf shouldn't actually be taken as a symbol of inferiority or submission. It's basically, you could say, a cultural thing. And within the scarf, there are plenty of women who are feminists, even in the Western sense. Then there's actually then complexities, because what you find is, especially on terms of family, in the 1990s, the regime decided that population explosion was bad and carried out probably the most effective world program of limiting population without the coercive methods you find in China, basically through education. One simple thing, that anyone getting married, the couples have to have family therapy, family instruction. The main part would be birth control. So you had before a population growth of about 4%, it basically has dropped to zero. It was, because before the idea was Islam is for big families, then Islam is for a good family, which is two children, which means zero population. So that was the policy from 1990 until this year. Now there is a shift there, because now people are talking that it's good to have a bigger population. We'll suffer if there are young people to support the old and so on. So this is being, I think, used by conservatives to have more of population growth, which then would mean, of course, then women would be then relegated to mostly to the home. So there are these complexities about back and forth. So after the revolution, actually, even in education, higher education, women were not permitted in certain fields. They were considered male disciplines. That broke down. And now there's again the talk of bringing back some of this. And I don't think they would succeed, but that becomes a mark of an arch conservative.
Yes, Al.
Thank you very much, Al.
Thank you. The microphone, please, because we are recording that.
Thank you very much for being persistent to have our speaker. It's a pleasure to hear the whole truth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A very pleasant and brief comment. Okay, thanks, Al. Other questions? Yes, Chris.
I was just wondering, do the countries around Israel and the Israeli populace kind of give a little bit of support towards the Iranian government for having nuclear technology, especially considering Israel has nuclear technology, and in fact, most people believe they have a nuclear program, in fact. Do you think that that kind of contributes to any real support, or at least just like, sure, why don't they have it?
Kind of there is that sentiment, but I don't know if people already think through it, because if the logic is that, you know, if it's basically nuclear technology, sure, but if it's nuclear weapons, then there are other implications. Then if Iran has nuclear weapons, why shouldn't Saudi Arabia have it? Why shouldn't Azerbaijan have it? Why shouldn't Armenia have it? So that's usually also the argument that sensible people in Iran would have also, not to go weaponize. Oh. It's one thing to say, well, you know, every country has the right to do it, but then you get a complete anarchy.
And I actually, I don't know, Professor Brahmin, agree or not, one of the most strongest opponents of the Iranian nuclear program is actually Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. They are very, very, very adamant about that. And I think that's for all kind of reasons. And the fight over Syria now, is it echoes that conflict too. Okay, other questions? Yes, Donna.
You talked about in 5051 that the British were feeding the American highbrow, I think you called it media in the United States, a certain agenda or message, and it was being printed. What do you think about the coverage in contemporary about the nuclear and the media in American media?
It is actually, I mean, I try to follow the individuals, especially in the New York Times, which journalist is what line. And you can't find a distinction there. In the New York Times, there is one person who tends to be alarmist, and I suspect his information comes from Israeli sources. Then there is another one who is much more cool-headed, and so every so often there's an alarmist article about how Iran is getting very close to it. Then a few days later, you'll have another article that someone tries to balance that off. So in the editorial board, I'm sure there is a lot of interesting discussions.
Yes, other questions? No comments? It's your last chance.
It was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Well, we will not thank you, and want to thank you, Professor Fahani, for coming, and thanks to all of you for joining us today. We'll see you next year in another lecture.